Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we sit down with Maryland Governor Wes Moore. The state's first black governor has hit the ground running during his first 6 months. He enjoys a 55% approval rating in a Gonzales poll released just this week. But he's also facing some challenges, the rising homicide and crime rates in Baltimore and the suburbs around D.C. The NAACP is also raising questions about poor performance of black students in the state's public schools. We're going to talk about all of those things and more with the governor. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Governor Moore, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
It's my pleasure. It's great to be on you, Harold. Good to talk to you.
Let's first start with what you announced today, and it relates to dealing with crime, specifically youth crime, in the state, something you're calling a Safe Summer Initiative. We have seen some really, really tough to swallow examples of violent youth crime. The Baby K incident, of course, in Prince George's County comes to mind for a lot of people. Talk to me about this initiative and how it may help stem the tide of violent crime in the state.
That's right. It's highlighting the fact that we're now going on over the past 8 years. We've seen how the non-fatal shooting rate in the state of Maryland has doubled in the past 8 years. In the past 8 years, we've seen how the homicide rate in Maryland has nearly doubled. So we're watching this surging of violence and this surging of horrific violence that's been going on for 8 years. And really what happened today with the announcement of the Safe Streets Initiative and also how we're taking a new approach to the way we're dealing with public safety is I'm basically saying enough. And we're not just looking at it from a perspective of how are we engaging our police forces or our legislative desk. This is about how we're engaging every element of government, every sector, every cabinet secretary, every agency is a part of it. And this includes really having an all-of-the-above approach when it comes to the way that we're going to deal with public safety. So, we've, in addition to doing things like making historic investments, $122 million in local law enforcement to make sure that they have the resources they need, to include $17.5 million in Baltimore City alone. It means that we put record investments in our the Office of the Attorney General and our prosecutors to make sure that we are getting and keeping these violent offenders off of our streets. It means that we've made record investments in the Maryland Coordination and Analysis Center to get these illegal guns out of our neighborhoods and also putting together policies and laws saying that someone with a history of a mental illness and a history of violence should not be able to purchase a firearm. So it's some common sense laws and common sense gun laws that we have on board. But it's also saying that we're not going to arrest or sentence our way out of something that's a larger societal challenge. But this is also about making sure we're making investments in our education system, in our mental health, $120 million going towards mental health. And it's also calling on the village elders. It's calling on the guardians. It's calling on the parents. It's calling on everybody who has connection to our young people to say, we want to work with you and we want to build with you and we need to create a society where, yes, we can put record investment of getting illegal guns off of our streets, but it also means we have to be able to work in coordination with communities and families that also know that the only rules that kids are following are not just the laws that we're passing in Annapolis. This is an all-in approach and an all-of-the-above approach about creating more opportunities for our young people, but also making sure that we're holding people to account when they are violators and repeat violators, particularly of violent crimes within our society. We are going to keep our community safe.
With all of those millions that you just mentioned, how do you hope specifically that this will translate to safer streets?
Well, I think the thing that to create safer streets, the people who are also helping to create safer streets need resources. And that's why we are not going to get better results by doing this on the cheap. You know, that we've got to make sure that, yes, local law enforcement and the people whose job it is to protect our society, that they have the resources and the training that they need to make sure that we have a law enforcement that's moving with appropriate intensity and absolute integrity and full accountability. But at the same time, it's not just about what we're going to do to provide more resources to police forces, that it is about making sure that we have mentors, that it is that we're supporting, mental health providers. That's the reason why Maryland now, with a bill that we introduced in the past, is now the first state in the country that has a service year option for high school graduates, because we want to get young people more involved in service and give them more pathways for economic growth and work and wages and wealth. And so it really is about how are we making sure that we are investing and how are we making sure that we're supporting everybody who has touch points with our young people. Because if they have the support that they need, if our young people have the support that they need, we are not going to have the issue and the challenges that we're facing right now. The challenge is that we've continued to starve our resources, starve our communities, starve our neighborhoods, and starve our children of resources. And if you really want to combat these things, both the immediacy of the crime challenge and the root causes, it means that you have to have a state government that's going to be engaged and involved and not just simply point blame at other people.
We are talking to Maryland Governor Wes Moore about all things Maryland. If you have a comment or a question, you can give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This past Sunday, you gave a speech at the 1,000 Fathers event in Prince George's County. Certainly a lot of people were listening to you, but what did you hear while you were there that perhaps you did not know beforehand?
Well, you know, I think what being there did, it completely reinforced the fact that for people who say that people in our communities don't care, they're not spending any time in our communities. Our community is full of loving parents and guardians and coaches and ministers and people who every single day are fighting on behalf of our children, who we need to do a better job of recognizing. But it's also knowing that we are asking for everybody to step up and for everybody to have a role in the development of our children and the opportunities they have. You know, I think about it this way, but where it's very personal. You know, I'm the father I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son. And I know that every single day I am working on behalf of all of our children, where we are working to pass laws. We are making sure that we're having strong budgets. We're making sure that we're fully funding public education. We're making sure that we can have resources and transportation assets. But do you know the best thing that I can do to help my children, my 12-year-old and my 9-year-old, is to be dad. It's to be present. It's for them to know that in me, they have a guide, they have a support, they have someone who's going to help them to understand what adulthood should look like, and someone's going to help them to do it. And so the beauty of that rally on Sunday was saying that, you know, for everybody in our communities, in our administration, you've got a partner, and you've got someone who is devoting our days and nights to making sure that we're creating a safer and a more prosperous and a more financially wealthy community that all of us can live in. And at the same time, I'm going to need every single mentor, every single guardian, every single parent, every single coach, every single minister to stand with us, because together we're going to be able to create the long-term impact that we're all seeking.
You were on Capitol Hill recently with Maryland's congressional delegation. One of the things that was discussed is the future of the FBI headquarters. No one knows what the decision is going to be, but it seems, at least from an outside observation, that those tea leaves are a little brown and a little crisp as it relates to Maryland. Your thoughts about how this is going?
Yeah, you're right that no one knows how it's going to end up. The only thing I know is how it should end up. And how it should end up is that this should be going to Maryland. And I'm not just saying that because I'm the governor of Maryland. You know, I'm a very data-driven person. And if you look at the data that was laid out, if you look at the criteria that the federal government and the GSA laid out for where they have, for what, how they're going to select a location, they said they're going to make the location selection based on things like cost, based on speed of delivery, based on transportation assets, and based on equity, right? If you look at the different criteria that they laid out and the future mission of the FBI, if you look at the criteria that they laid out, Maryland wins on each and every one of those criteria. We can get it done faster. We can get it done cheaper. We have transportation assets that are ready to go. If you look at the future mission of the FBI, where they talk about the importance of cyber, where Maryland is the home of U.S. Cyber Command. It's the home of Fort Meade. It's the home of the Naval Academy. It's the home of some of the top institutions of higher education in this country with a focus on cyber. And if you look at equity, there's no question that Prince George's County is a place that, if you're making an equity argument, that the building should be in, and not Fairfax County, Virginia. And so I believe this should end up in Maryland based on the merits of the case. Now, I do know this has been a long time battle, and it's been going on for a decade, and the Maryland delegation led by Steny Hoyer has just been absolutely extraordinary in pushing this fight. But this is a legacy-defining project for the Biden administration, and we're hoping that the Biden administration makes the right decision when it comes to making sure that they're actually staying to their criteria for how they're going to make this election.
We are talking to Maryland Governor Wes Moore about all things Maryland. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I see you, Sheila and Gina. Just hold on. We will get to you. There are some other questions I think are really, really important, however, that we need to ask the governor. One of the other questions is, do you have Magic Johnson on speed dial? Because, you know, obviously he's one of the new minority owners of the Washington Commanders. There's all of this discussion about them moving to Virginia. It's like FBI headquarters all over again. What's going on with that? What can you tell us about that? And are you doing any lobbying to keep them in Maryland?
Yes, I mean, I'm committed to keeping them in Prince George's County. You know, Maryland has been the home of the Commanders for the last 25 years. And once the deal and once the sale is finalized, I look forward to personally meeting with the new owners and hearing their vision for the futures of Commanders football here in Maryland. But as far as I can see, we're the only place that's really advocating for the new Commander Stadium that moving forward with transformative work and a package that I think is going to be very appealing to the new ownership team, to include the fact that in our first budget, we made investments to include things like putting $400 million in state funding along the Blue Line corridor near FedEx Field. So we're focused on making sure that this can be an opportunity not just for a successful team to be placed in Prince George's County, but we want a successful neighborhood. We want to make sure that we're focused on not just success on the field, but what does success look like outside of the stadium? And that's why we're investing so heavily in the area. But we think that's going to be a very, very attractive option for the new Commanders leadership team. So once the deal is finalized, I'm looking forward to personally getting involved and making sure that they know that that Maryland should be the home for them.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sheila from Maryland, we're going to talk to you. Gina from Prince George's County, we're going to talk to you as well. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. We continue this conversation with Maryland Governor Wes Moore in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're sitting down with Maryland Governor Wes Moore. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Sheila, calling from Maryland. Thanks for hanging on, Sheila. What's on your mind?
Hello, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So,
hi, Sheila.
Hi, how are you doing, Governor?
I'm blessed. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. So I have a question for you and slash comment. I hear you talking about resources for our children, our boys and girls who are in need, right? Now, my job is to find resources for those children in the community, whether they are school age or not. The problem I'm having, and the question I would like to know, is if any of that money will be funneled down to help support early Head Start as well as Head Start, because our smaller babies have families too. They experience trauma and violence just as well as older population. So that's really my question. How can we help support those families, because there seems to be a slight bias?
Thank you so much, Sheila. You're breaking up a little bit, but I think I you're asking about trauma and children and funding for it. Is that correct?
You're talking about child care, correct, Sheila?
Oh, child care.
Right. I'm asking if the same or part of the funding will be funneled down to early Head Start and Head Start programs, because those programs also support families of at-risk youth.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And I'm so glad you asked this question, because, you know, when we first started, going through the process of running, this was actually one of the big issues that I wanted to be able to tackle and make sure that we're making progress and making momentum on, because the reality is that when it comes to educational supports, and when it comes to child care supports, our state starts too late and we make it too expensive. Where if you look at child care supports are actually battling the numbers for college tuition for certain families when it comes to actually providing child care support. And if you look at what's happened to child care providers over the COVID period, this has been a devastating period for child care providers in the state of Maryland. We're just in the state of Maryland. We've had over 800 child care providers close since COVID. And people oftentimes forget that the child care providers are oftentimes they're female entrepreneurs, but they are never treated as such. And when you consider the fact that we have so many children who then end up starting late and not getting the educational supports that they need, where 80% of brain development happens in a child by the time that child is 5 years old, we know as a state we're falling behind. And so in our first budget, we did not just make record investments when it came to early childhood supports and early childhood education, but actually specifically focused on legislation and funding that went towards early child care providers and early childhood providers. Because if we can get our children at an earlier age, if we can get them on a pathway to being able to become lifelong learners, to being able to make sure we're addressing the things like the word gap, and to being able to address mental health supports for not just children but also families, we're putting ourselves in a much stronger position. So that's the reason that we were so aggressive early on in our administration to be able to address this issue, because the work that you do and the work that your colleague does is not just important work. Frankly, it's budget-saving work for the state of Maryland, and we need to do a better job of supporting it.
Yeah. Sheila, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Gina, calling from Prince George's County. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I first of all want to applaud the gentleman that's online today. Tonight.
This is the governor of Maryland, Wes
the
Moore.
Of Maryland.
Yeah,
yes.
Gentleman, certainly, but he is the governor of Maryland. Please go right ahead.
Yes, I got in kind of late, picked the call kind of late. However, I have a concern with gun violence. That's my main concern. Is there any way we can set up a stop, siege, and search checkpoint throughout the area to try to get the guns off the street, and as well as placing metal detectors in our schools? That's a major issue. We need to put funding in protecting our kids from the gun violence. And gun metal detectors are a needed necessity to keep our kids safe. Also have it where you put money aside in the budget to set up stop, search, and seize checkpoints to get the guns out of the possession of these teenage kids. They need to just set them up, period, because there's no other way you're going to be able to stop the gun violence unless who are stopping and pulling folks over and actually taking the guns from these teenagers.
Gina, thank you so much for your question. At least I would think, Governor, that the Fourth Amendment would have some issues with just stopping and searching for guns. But with that in mind, I think that's her question really suggests the seriousness of this gun issue in the state as well as across the country.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And first, Gina, thank you so much. You know, this issue is one that has just been, it's just not been perplexing. It's been heartbreaking, the fact that our state has not come up with a real coordinated solution to this. We're going on 8 straight years now where we've watched the homicide rate in the state of Maryland nearly double over the past 8 years in the state of Maryland. And we have not come up with a coordinated response until now. And it's the reason why we had our press conference earlier today to focus on this issue of public safety. But you cannot talk about public safety unless you're talking about the guns. You know, and this means passing common sense gun laws. And it is the reason why we did things like in our first 90 days, we did things like making sure that people who have history of mental illness and also a history of violence cannot purchase a firearm. That we raised the age and saying that no one under the age of 21 should be allowed to purchase a weapon. But it's also about getting these illegal guns out of our streets and out of our neighborhoods. And that's the reason we made record investments in things like in things like license plate readers. Because for a lot of these illegal guns that we continue to see in our neighborhoods, they're not being built here. They're being trafficked in from other states. And if we're not coordinated, if we are not coordinating our law enforcement agencies, if we're not coordinating our analysis and our intelligence sharing, we are going to continue having these illegal guns flooding our neighborhoods and making us less safe. So I am focused on not just making sure that we're passing common sense gun laws here in the state of Maryland and taking the lead and being unafraid about that. I'm also focused on making sure that we are getting and keeping these illegal guns out of our neighborhoods, making sure that they are not getting in the hands of our children, and knowing that coming up with a true public safety platform, it does mean an all of the above approach in the way that we're addressing it. But part of the all of the above means going after these illegal guns and getting them out of our neighborhood.
Gina, thank you so much. I will say, Governor, and I'm sure you do know this, that while, yes, the lion's share of the legal guns that are made in this country, I'm not talking about the ghost guns and the like, are made outside. But there are two, you know, manufacturers. Beretta is in Accokeek. LWRC International is in Cambridge. And that is not to say that those two companies are the guns that we usually see on the street. But again, that just talks about the kinds of issues related to guns, legal and otherwise.
That's right.
That is part of the big debate. I want to talk to you about education. As you probably know, the NAACP is having a two-day conference. It's in Baltimore County, I believe, and they've invited all of the school superintendents to talk about poor performance by Black students. Now, the reporting is that it has not, at least today, not as well attended as they would hope. And there has also been some reporting about, you know, them not being able to get some straight answers from, you know, some of the officials from the Maryland board. That notwithstanding, how would you attack this issue of poor performance for Baltimore and Prince George's counties kind of top the list for Black students in public schools?
Yeah, I mean, there needs to be a greater measure of accountability for how we are preparing our students, how we're supporting our educators, how we're really providing a better economic, a better educational environment to which will eventually lead to better economic circumstances. You know, when we came in, we said that we're going to prioritize public education. And if you look at what we did during our first 90 days, we were able to do things like, you know, invest more in public education and public education supports than any governor in the history of the state of Maryland to include increased accountability measures, and also doing things like passing legislation that focused on the teacher shortage, because right now we have a massive teacher shortage in the state of Maryland. And so we introduced and passed something called the Teacher Shortage Act of 2023, which focused on making sure that we are recruiting and retaining top educators inside of our classroom. And so by being able to work with our local jurisdictions, by being able to work with our local school boards, which is really the ones who are accountable for a lot of that work, by being able to make sure that they have the funding and the support that they need from the state level, and making sure that we have increased levels of accountability, we think are going to be crucial. You know, now I understand that the Maryland State Board of Education is an independent entity, but I also know that in this moment, anything and everything that we're trying to accomplish as a state, it's going to require us having a world-class public education system for all of our children and not just some. And so that's why our focus has been on making sure that we're building out greater measurements of support and accountability for our public schools to ensure that that's actually creating pathways for real work wages and wealth for all of our children and not just some who happen to exist in some of the either wealthier or historically more advanced educational jurisdictions. Mm.
June is National Home Ownership Month. There's a big multi-million-dollar project coming up in Montgomery County. But more broadly, unless you live well outside of the D.C. suburbs or Baltimore suburbs, living in the state of Maryland is just doggone expensive.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans for any incentives for new homeowners or people who are really trying to, you know, to own their own homes or get back into it, you know, after we saw what happened in the early 2000s and as well as, you know, during the pandemic where some people did, you know, lose their homes?
Absolutely. And I think it's twofold. You know, one is I've been very clear that Maryland must increase its affordable housing options all throughout the state. And we are committed to ensuring that Marylanders in every county across the state have access to affordable housing. And so if you look at things like our first budget that we passed, it includes things like $88 million to construct affordable housing, $21 million to help people to purchase homes, and particularly first-time home buyers, $25 million in my supplemental budget. That's providing this much needed affordable rental housing for Maryland working families. And so we've got to do things like increase the inventory. We need to do things like actually renovate the current inventory that's inhabitable. And we need to do more to have laws that's going to assist people to stay inside their home. But you bring up a really, really important point that I do not want to lose sight on. We've got to create an ownership society here. Because right now in the state of Maryland, we have an 8-to-1 racial wealth gap. And we know that's not because one group is working 8 times harder. That's because we have systems and legacies that are in place that are creating these type of wealth gaps. And when you look at things like unfair appraisal value, that has been one of the reasons that's been one of the greatest wealth thefts that we have seen in our state's history. So it's the reason we passed legislation to actually focus on things like addressing unfair appraisal values in historically redlined neighborhoods. It's the reason that we put things like the $21 million to help people to purchase homes, because I want people to purchase. I want people to have equity. I want people to own, because ownership is how you get to wealth. And when we say the pathway to work, wages, and wealth, that doesn't just mean jobs. It means I want people to have something generational so they can pass something off to their children besides debt. It means I want people to own more than they owe. I want to increase wealth for people, and particularly for African Americans, communities of color, and people who have historically been left out of this conversation. And so affordable housing and making sure that you have housing options is a core part of the equation to get to work, wages, and wealth.
Real quick, you talk about the racial wealth gap today on the D.C. Council. Kenyon McDuffie, the council member at large, had a public hearing about reparations for the descendants of enslaved D.C. residents. Cori Bush, Congresswoman from Missouri, has been talking about reparations, a $14 trillion price tag for Black Americans. What are your thoughts about that for the state of Maryland?
Yeah, if you look at the cost and the impact of the racial wealth gap, it's not just what how it's impacted individual communities. The cost of the racial wealth gap to the country has been $16 trillion in GDP over the past two decades. And that's not even GDP of a group, that's GDP. And so we have to be clear that watching these disparities has not, that's had an impact on economic and the economic prospects of the entire country. I know the state of Maryland is going through its process and actually has introduced legislation to be able to explore and look at this. And I encourage that process. You know, the thing that I know, though, is when we talk about what is the cost of the economic disparity that we have seen in our country, and the fact that we still have implications of it sitting on board right now, that the policies that we are pushing together and thinking about what do reparative policies actually look like to make sure that we're addressing a harm that has been caused, but also a harm that's still being felt, is something that does become important for jurisdictions to be able to look at. So you know, we have to be honest about our history. We have to be honest about the impacts of our history, and we have to be aggressive on what policy solutions are we then going to put forward that can you know, not just address historical wrongs, but then also thinking about how do you create policies that are creating economic momentum that we can address these issues once and for all.
I got a tweet from a listener just now who asked, what can you do or are you willing to do to address mental health support for police departments across the state? We often talk about those who commit these crimes, particularly young people and mental health issues and social services, wraparound services and the like. But this particular person is expressing concern about the men and women who are on the street every day dealing with these kinds of crimes and the support that they need for mental health.
Yeah, it's a great question, because it's fundamentally going back to how are we helping the helpers? Because oftentimes the ones who don't get the support and the ones who don't seek the support are the supporters, and they don't realize the burden that is continuing to play and weigh on them as well. And so it's part of the reason why that we ended up putting over $110 million into mental health supports, but saying that if the capital that we're putting towards that was going towards education for mental health, for example, that wasn't just going towards children. It was going towards educators. And so when we're talking about mental health, it's not just about how are we providing mental health for society. It's also about how we're providing mental health for people who are first responders and law enforcement and firefighters and people who are dealing with the traumas of our society every single day. That these people that are doing this work, and frankly, who are doing things that for most human beings would not do, that we've got to find ways of being able to support them. And I tell you, I saw it in my own life where, you know, before I ran for office, one of the things I did was I was a military officer and I led soldiers in combat in Afghanistan. And we saw how mental health wasn't properly dealt with in the military, even though the military is doing a better job now, but especially for example, the officers and the senior non-commissioned officers, because oftentimes we forget to help the helpers. And so that is something that we didn't just put resources in towards it, but we also made sure that in our practice and our operations, that was something that was being thought about and something that we're going to be delivering on as well.
Let me go to the phone lines real quick. Anthony calling from Maryland. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead. What's on your mind, yeah. Anthony?
Yeah, I wanted to ask the governor. I've been trying to build a private school in the Crownsville area for the last 5 years, asking questions about disadvantaged children, underprivileged children, because our education for our kids, or what kids we have at the age of 14, what resources do you have that I can tap into to help me develop this school?
Right. So I'm sorry. Let me make sure I heard correctly. You said you're developing a school right now?
Yeah, he says he's trying to develop a school in the Crownsville area for underserved, disadvantaged youth.
Wonderful. Well, first I got to tell you, thank you for your work and thank you for your service. Because, you know, you're working with a group and you're working with a population that oftentimes people are either choosing not to work with or we are not providing the right kind of support. So I applaud you for the work that you're doing and for the work that you're getting done on this. The best place, when you think about the local work, that's taking place and the ones who are authorizing schools and new schools, that really is something for the local jurisdiction where they are the ones with the authority to be able to grant licenses for schools and licenses for people to be able to stand up and scale out school operations. So one thing I would tell you is coordinate with your local jurisdictions, you know, both the local in Crownsville but also with the county. But then also make sure that you understand the resources that we have and we provided for the state level for our schools and for our students to be able to benefit from. You know, we in our first budget ended up putting over $900 million that was going towards funding, blueprint implementation, et cetera, and $8.8 billion that was going towards our public schools as a whole, both record investments. And so there's capital for supporting our educators and people who are building our platform. But the first stop would have to be your local jurisdiction because they're the ones who would get the licenses for it.
Okay. Anthony, thank you so much for your phone call. Governor, political question, as you know, the race for Senate is hot and heavy. David Trone, Angela also Brooks, just to mention just a few of the high-profile names. Are you going to endorse? Have you made a decision? What's the word from you?
Yeah, I know this is going to be an incredibly important race. And it's an important race because when you think about what's on the line and what's at stake, it's not just that this is going to be an important seat for the country. This is going to be a really important seat for our state. And this still goes back to, you know, us having the right partners. I'm thankful for the fact that we have really strong really strong candidates who have declared in the race. And I know that there are still others who are looking at it and examining their race. And I know that the thing that I'm looking for right now is I want to make sure that we are running a substantive, that we are running an issue-based, and we are running a positive campaign, that we are making sure that our nominee is going to be somebody who is going to be strong, not just strong going into a general election, but also is going to have the full support of the party going into as they end up assuming the seat. So I'm excited about what we've seen so far and a lot of the candidates, and we have quite a few friends who are inside the race right now. And I know that while I, you know, while I plan on having statements and getting involved in the future on this, what I'm eager for to see is I want us running a substantive, I want us running an issue-based, and I want us running a positive campaign. And the foolishness of politics and that sometimes creeps into political realm, I don't want to see us as a party or us as a state delve into that.
When do you think you may make an endorsement?
Oh, I think it's still very early because I think we're still watching how races are being pulled together. We're still seeing. Who's actually going to be in and how they're thinking about this race. But I plan on, when I plan on getting involved, I plan on my voice being heard. Mm.
July 1st, recreational marijuana will be legal in the state. Do you have any concerns?
I know that I'm fully committed to creating the adult use cannabis market. That's going to bolster our economy. That's going to benefit those who've been disproportionately impacted and affected by this war on drugs, that we've been working diligently to ensure that legal youth sales can begin smoothly on July 1st, and we're prepared to provide assistance to people who are seeking to participate. And that includes things like, you know, the fact that right now we have the Cannabis Business Assistance Fund, which is currently accepting applications for assistance to small businesses, who are entering into the adult use market. We have the Community Reinvestment and Repair Fund, which is going to help community initiatives in low-income communities that were particularly hurt by cannabis prohibition. And so I know that in the state of Maryland, we are going to be thoughtful. We are going to be transparent. But we're also going to be moving fast, because I do not want to create space for the illegal market to take up market share. And, you know, the people of Maryland, they spoke pretty clearly, and it's clear what they wanted. They wanted quicker access. They wanted opportunity to underserved communities. They wanted safety guardrails, and they wanted investment in our communities. And those are the measures that are serving as North Stars for how we're going to do it and how our administration is going to lead on it.
I really have a final question, and this is, it's a personal question, but I think it's important. The First Lady revealed more broadly after inauguration that she has MS, multiple sclerosis. Yeah. And she's been dealing with those challenges. This is not a new thing. But you ran for governor. You won the seat, you know, with this knowledge. As a husband and governor, number one, how do you balance the, you know, those challenges? And does her diagnosis with MS give you a different view as it relates to dealing with issues of health care?
Well, thank you for asking. And, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't just marry my best friend. I married a warrior. Mm-hmm. And someone who is just an absolute rock. And, you know, I still remember to this day the moment when we were together and we got the diagnosis. We were still at that point just dating. And I told her, I said, I'm with you.
Wow.
And we've been together ever since, and nothing has changed. You know, I think it does serve as an important reminder to me of the fact that every single day people are dealing with stuff. They're dealing with struggles. They're dealing with healthcare challenges. They're dealing with challenges in their own families. And every day they're just doing their best to try to make it through. And it really serves, I think, a motivation for me, and frankly, a motivation for my wife, our First Lady, where all we're trying to do in state government is make things a little bit easier on people. That people are working and they're fighting hard and they're dealing with the cards that they've been dealt. And the only thing that they're asking for from state government is make sure you're working hard every day that you're actually seeing us, that you're actually understanding us. And so I do think having a wife who's dealing with this illness, and doing it so valiantly and so bravely, and knowing that she is one of many Marylanders who are dealing with whether it's MS or other autoimmune deficiencies, or other illnesses, that our responsibility is to continue to do our best and to do our part to make sure that we are both dealing with the present and dealing with the now, but then also making sure that people in our communities and people in our disability community, that they're being seen and they're being heard and that their stories are being remembered as well. So it's not just something that's helped to shape the way I think about the role of governor. It's something that's helped to shape the way that I think about myself as a husband and a father and a human being. And it's something that I'll never lose sight of.
Governor Westmore, thank you so much for participating in this conversation. We wish your wife, the First Lady, continued good health. And again, thank you so much. We will be in touch.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
Sure thing. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, June 15th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.